Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Michael Siegel, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. And today, presented alongside the likes of Andy Murray and Martina Navratilova by Michael Siegel, who I think has missed a trick by not pronouncing his name Segal, a la Steven Segal. But anyway...
In fact, you got quite excited about the prospect of Michael Segal, didn't you? Sorry, Michael.
Michael Segal, one of our Kickstarter backers, who is chair of the Pensions Committee for the WTA Tour, which sounds like a... pretty interesting job.
Pretty stand-up job, that, isn't it?
Pretty stand-up job. So Michael Siegel, not Segal. Thank you very much providing that lovely intro to our show today. A little bit of housekeeping. David Law, who joins me at Costa Coffee in the Putney Exchange, before we start talking about this week's tennis. And that is to say that last week we persistently mispronounced the name of Amanda. Take it away, David.
Oh, no. Amanda Anisimova,
yeah.
Who we were calling Amanda Animisova.
Yeah.
Various other
think
versions.
Rolls off the tongue nicely.
And actually, we were saying them
a bit like Michael Segal, really.
Yeah, we were saying them alternately wrong
we were.
And right. And so anyway, Amanda
Anisimova. I bet in 10 years' time, when she's, you know, a 15-time Grand Slam champion, has been world number one for 5 years, we'll listen back to that sweet episode when we couldn't pronounce her name properly.
Yeah, once
but
in a
from
while.
This day forward, David, we will correctly call her Amanda Anisimova.
Yeah, remember when we didn't know how to say Goran Ivanisevic?
Was there a time?
Yeah, yesterday. Carry on.
So anyway, that's last week. We have righted those wrongs, hopefully. Thanks, as always, to all the people that pointed out those wrongs.
Yes, thank you.
Various forms of social media. Luckily, David, I think all the people that we have to talk about this week, I think we are sorted re-pronunciations.
Speak for yourself.
Right, okay. Now, I'm going to offer you the choice because it's always contentious. We had, a brilliant, I think overall the women's tournament was better in Indian Wells, but the men's final was better than the
yes.
men's final. So... whichever final we talk about first, we will talk about all of that side of things first. So I give you the choice of Federer Delpo or Osaka Kazatkina.
I think I'm going to go for Del Potro Federer for the reason that it is so recent in my mind, because it was last night. And I know that it was last night because I was supposed to go to bed at 9 o'clock because I'd got a 4:30 alarm call, and there I was still 11:30 with just 5 hours sleep to go, still watching. And the reason is because it was just, well, it was a bit like the Miami match of last year between Kyrgios and Federer, and that same thing happened in that match. Just couldn't go to bed because it was just so pulsating. And this one had everything, because Del Potro came out just on fire, walloping the ball. It was so reminiscent of the last couple of sets of the US Open final that they played in 2009. And then, really, I did not see Federer coming back in that match the way it was going. He had to dig in to the reserves. Part of it was he was having to show his fight, and I think that is underestimated. What a gritty scrapper he can be.
Swarthy pirate Federer with his beard yeah. and his scrappiness.
He's not afraid to get down and dirty in a tennis match if he has to. And, you know, drill the ball through Juan Martín Del Potro's chest as he tried to do deep in the third set, which, incidentally, I think ended up working against him because he seemed to get Del Potro mad. That
favorite
doesn't happen very
ever
often.
Stare yeah. from Del Potro at that, Federer. To Federer's turned back. And so I think Federer knew he was going to get a stare, so he turned his back very quickly.
He completely blanked him, didn't he? But I felt that Federer kept himself afloat with the fighting spirit, but he also had to adapt his game, and you saw the way he was having to just conjure shots off with his wrist and off his toes because the sheer velocity of the ball coming at him, the depth and the relentlessness of the Del Potro game was frankly too much for him. He was being overwhelmed, and he managed to just find the magic, and that's what he has above everybody else that I've ever seen play the game, is this ability to find another gear, not with power, not with depth, not even with serving, but just using the ball in a way that no one else can and use their power against them. So he gets into this third set, looks as if he's absolutely on course for the win. He's got two match points,
yeah,
three match five, points.
5-4 on serving for it, 40-15.
Yeah.
And so he had two consecutive, three in total, two consecutive.
Partly it was wrestled from his grasp, but actually it was... Choke feels too negative and harsh. He certainly got tight, nervous, and blew it, frankly. He did blow it.
Two double faults in the deciding tiebreak. That is unusual. Yeah. And a handful of unforced errors as well. As you say, I mean, Del Potro didn't put a foot wrong in that tiebreak, but two double faults in a tiebreak from Roger Federer, that is unheard of.
But there was also, when he did get drilled with that backhand, Del Potro, he did get angry. And, I mean, he was already hitting the ball incredibly well. And then he sort of went into otherworldliness with the power, because it was like a hurricane coming through the Indian Wells tennis garden. It was just knocking Federer off his feet. The rallying balls that Federer, perfectly decent ones that Federer was putting in, were just being clobbered for clean winners.
And not just off the forehand either, the backhand as well. He drills that backhand so flat.
And the other thing that really struck me was how well Del Potro played at the net. There were a few times when Federer tried his really exaggerated slice that just drops and brings in the big, you know, sight-wise, it looks like he's lumbering Del Potro. He actually runs and moves a heck of a lot better than that. But when he was getting to the net, he was brought in. But he's so big, it's hard to get it past him. So Federer's just absolutely whacking the ball at him with all sorts of spin on it and loop on it. And Del Potro's just stepping out of the way of it and middling it away for clean winner volleys. I thought he was fantastic. That's the second best I've ever seen Del Potro play.
Second
to the US Open final last two sets, but it was quite similar. There are times in both of those matches when it has felt as though Roger Federer is using a pea shooter against a tank. You know, and he's a powerful guy with weapons of his own, Federer. It just felt, you know, it was. We all like to use the Thor and the Hulk comparisons for Del Potro, and it felt like a Marvel tennis match. You know, this Roger Sorcerer against Juan Martín Del Potro. Cough, wanted to say that.
That was just off the top of his head, yeah, ladies and
yeah,
gentlemen.
I just
obviously
wrote that one last night, yeah. having studied all sorts of other people's. But no, I can really frame it like that in my head of this guy trying to find spells and magic and wizardry to deal with this wrecking machine down the other end of the court. And that's what Del Potro was.
He was absolutely amazing. Yeah, 7-6 in the third. And we have to talk about... incidentally, that's his first ever Masters 1000 win.
Which is absurd, Del Potro. Isn't it?
It's just absurd, yeah. It's absolutely ridiculous. Won a Grand Slam before he won a Masters 1000. So that's huge in itself. But what he dealt with yesterday in terms of the pro Federer crowd, we know you get a pro Federer crowd anywhere, no matter who's playing. That is standard, and he's earned it, and no one wants to take that from him. But it was uncomfortable, to say the least, at times yesterday, I think. I think he channeled it well. He used it to get himself fired up. I'd love to know what I'd love to know what Federer really thinks about it, whether he actually thinks, guys, you're not doing me any favours here. You know, I'm glad you're supporting me, but chill out. Chill out, dudes.
No, I don't. I honestly don't think he's thinking that at all. I think he's riding it as like a wave. I really do.
It's bizarre, though, isn't it? Because Del Potro is, in many ways, it's a very different love to the love that Federer generates. But Del Potro is one of the most loved players. You know, I think about sitting outside the media centre at the US Open last year, waiting for you to record the podcast, and I could hear the chants of Delpo, those football chants, those Delpo, coming from, what was it? It was grandstand court, wasn't it? Where he was coming back from two sets of love down against Dominic Thiem and was battling through the flu and all of that. And it was one of the most moving sounds I've ever heard. He is, in one very particular way, more loved than Federer, or certainly evokes more raw emotion than Federer. But, and yet, people were still cheering his missed serves yesterday. His missed first serve. So
it's an interesting one, because even before that match, a couple of days ago, I started a talking point about whether tennis should bring in rules onto the tours and into the slams that can maybe penalise a player if the crowd support gets too much and starts putting off an opponent, etc., like they do in Davis Cup, is what I suggested. Should that happen? Now, the majority of people were like, no, that's ridiculous. So I think over 70% of people thought that's nonsense and you can't do that. A lot of people got very upset that they felt that having to go at them as Federer fans. And look, he is the point of reference, the main point of reference, and I would go back to the match against Djokovic at the US Open 2015, the one against Kyrgios last year in Miami, this one. And look, there are many others involving many other players. There have been certain matches Andy Murray's played at Wimbledon. There's Garbiñe Muguruza getting very upset against the French player. I can't even remember who it was.
Miljanovic, over on Longlen last year.
So, look, it doesn't just happen in Federer matches, but there is no question there are times watching Roger Federer matches when the sheer adulation, the sheer desperation for people to have him win and to underline their love for him by winning again and getting to celebrate the moment, sometimes it goes to a level that is quite uncomfortable to watch. And at the same time, do you want to remove that raw emotion from a tennis crowd?
I absolutely don't know. What I would say, well,
I'd go absolutely mental.
So would I. But how do you think Fergus Murphy dealt with it? Isn't it down to the umpire to manage that emotion?
Well, I was watching this at the time, and I know Fergus Murphy a little bit. I've known him for 20 years. He was on the tour when I was on the tour. Spent a couple of hours in a car driving through the Swiss mountains.
That's
during
David
his
Law's
start.
History as a professional tennis player that he's, you know, failed to mention up until this point.
Yeah, and so I remember us driving through these mountains and having a. He's a really interesting company. He's a really interesting guy, and a lot of the umpires are actually. I mean, it's a very unusual lifestyle. The fact that they're traveling 30 weeks a year on this circuit, they have all of them having dinner together. I remember back when I was on the tour, it was always having dinner and talking about Jeff Tarango and the run-ins and scrapes they'd had with him. I've told Jeff this since, and it's just, how do you deal with these situations, these characters? These days it would be Nick Kyrgios. Now, Fergus Murphy is somebody who's in the chair, and he likes a row. He likes to have back chat. If a player gets in his face, he gives them some back. He's got plenty of one-liners of his own. Doesn't always go down that well. I mean, some of the arguments I've seen him have with Andy Roddick over the years, you know, I could watch them on YouTube quite happily because they're just so entertaining. He's had some with Andy Murray. And I don't know what all the players' opinions of him are behind the scenes, because, you know, it's very different when they're out there, but some of them would be wound up by it, and some people would be thinking, you know, he just needs to stay out of it, stop trying to be too clever, just call the score and look after the match. Personally, I thought he did an excellent job yesterday, and, you know,
because you love aggro.
Well, I do love aggro, but I also think it requires somebody who's not just going to be rattled the moment that Roger Federer gets a little bit upset.
Yeah.
Because a lot of umpires, I think it would be very tempting when you've got such a massive crowd behind Federer, and all he has to do is raise his voice in your direction or look like he's ticking you off, and that crowd are going to be on your case. You see it in football matches, the home crowd getting influenced by the referee. And I'm not saying that umpires are going to try and be unfair in favour of Roger Federer, but I think human nature will tell you that it can rattle you a bit.
Yeah, look at the stats on penalties at Old Trafford.
I like the fact that Fergus Murphy was having none of it, quite honestly. I think he does like to grandstand just a little bit. When he said to the crowd, ladies and gentlemen, I think it was something like, could I just draw your attention to the words you're using between serves, what's coming out of your mouth, basically. And I thought, well, funny line, first of all. But I like the fact that he's not going to be intimidated by Roger Federer or by Juan Martín Del Potro. He was trying to just manage the match. And Richard Ings, who used to be an excellent chair umpire for the ATP, was head of all the rules. He tweeted, actually, you know, it is not surprising that players get grumpy in a match like that because they want to win so much. It's really tense. And they're gonna get upset. You've got to not make it worse. You've got to find a way to just keep the match moving. And Fergus Murphy did that.
Crowd aside, Del Potro always brings out grumpy Fed, doesn't he? What is it about Del Potro?
Well, he rattles him like few others do. Because
unlike any others, I mean, obviously, currently. Yeah. There was a line in a write-up I read on tennis.com, in the headline, actually, it said it's a victory that's put the edge back into the ATP. And I really agree with that because, look, I love Federer like everyone. I love seeing him play his best. I love his tennis. But there is nobody in any sport, possibly with the exception of football, but there's no individual in any sport that I like or am a fan of enough to not want to see a contest. I could, you know, I could be watching a member of my family play and I'd still not want to see them win 6-love, 6-love. I love a contest more than anything.
Even when Reading are playing?
Well, I did slightly give football a bit of an exception there. But that's for another day, another podcast.
Not doing very well, Reading, are they?
Oi, people in glass houses. I don't want to see, as beautiful as it may sometimes look, I never want to see a procession for anyone to a title or through even an individual match. So the reignition of this rivalry.
You need jeopardy, don't you?
Absolutely.
For sporting greatness.
I mean, the people inside that stadium don't. There's an awful lot of people that do just want to see, would love nothing more than to watch Federer win Love and Love. I accept that is a thing, but
I
don't feel that way.
Most people would prefer to have seen Federer win 7-6 in the third than win 6-1, 6-1.
Yeah, but if it's a choice between him not winning and him winning Love and Love.
Yes, well, I agree with you. They would go for the
But
win.
Anyway, I really like that line. It's put the edge back in the ATP because, barring those absolute die-hard Federer fans, this is what tennis needs. This is absolutely what tennis needs. And Del Potro's now up to 6 in the world on current form.
He can take it out of people's hands. That's the interesting thing. You can stick him at his best into any moment over the last 15 years when Nadal was dominating, when Djokovic was dominating, when Federer was dominating. If you stick Del Potro at his best up against any of them, he will win some of the matches and he will take away some of their Grand Slam titles if he was stuck into a final against these guys.
It's a very good point. And Federer stays at number one. Had he won Indian Wells, he would have been guaranteed to stay at number one throughout Miami, whatever happened. He could have pulled out of Miami. I'm not saying that was necessarily ever an option, but the fact that he didn't win the final means he now has to reach the quarters of Miami in order not to cede the number one to Nadal. Now, I think there's a possibility that he might have pulled out of Miami had he been assured of that number one position, but it ain't happening now.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. Wonder if I'll get a shave now.
Yeah, I don't know. Swarthy Fed. I'm not sure about it.
There's a line that somebody pointed out to me that our good friend and occasional contributor, particularly at Queen, Gigi Salmon, described Roger Federer with a beard as bad Superman. There's a film of Superman where...
Superman 3, isn't it?
Yeah, where he gets his... where he gets his alter ego.
Oh, no, not 4.
And, all right, well, anyway, 3
no,
now.
We don't like
okay,
4.
Okay, so he gets his alter ego, who's got a bit of a stubble, and who's in a really bad mood, and he's trying to beat people
Superman
up.
Yeah, but Superman was horrible.
Yeah, so... Have a shave, Rog.
He was an imposter. It's funny because he's a man that spent 20 years cultivating the image as the ultimate smooth guy. I mean, if there's one sort of adjective to describe Roger Federer's sort of aesthetic image, you'd probably go with smooth. So there's a certain irony in the bid. Maybe he just wants to escape from being smooth Roger Federer.
Pete
for
Sampras
a week.
Grew a goatee when he was closing in on 6 successive years at world number one. At the end of the year, he was so sort of drained and stressed and tired. He grew a beard and. He started to play rubbish. And I told him, actually.
Marginal gains.
Yeah, didn't go down very well.
Marginal beard-based gains. Before we move on to talk about the women's competition in Indian Wells, just a couple of bits to touch upon. Borna Coric challenging Federer in that semi-final. Could it finally be happening for Borna Coric?
Well, I think what is it finally happening for Borna Coric? I'm really pleased for him because he's had a couple of rough years.
Rough,
really just... plateaued completely and actually gone away, disintegrated really at his game. He's had, I think he had a big injury as well. But I mean, you know, when you think of the excitement levels when he first came on the scene and he had a couple of big wins, almost feel as though a couple of the big wins he had came too easily against big name players who clearly were not at their best. Mm-hmm. And it made you feel as though this guy is taking over against them. Well, he probably wasn't. And he was probably playing a high level against great players who just were nowhere near their best level, and he's had to go back and work on his game. He's guided now by Riccardo Piatti, who has had a hand in so many good players like Ivan Ljubicic, who is incidentally the manager of Borna Coric as well, which is another little interesting sideline.
And Riccardo Piatti, former coach of, thanks very much for the segue, Milos Raonic, who I think it's safe to say he's not announced anything, but I mean, marks out of 10 for the Goran Ivanišević coaching trial are probably, you know, relative to his results previously, that's an enormous week.
Good
for
solid
for
8.
At least an 8. I was almost going to say 9 then.
8.5.
And also, in terms of the neutral observer, Goran Ivanišević courtside interviews are now a thing, which is a marvelous development.
Yeah, didn't he do one when he was watching his man Raonic against Sam Querrey
and
got
wasn't
asked
impressed.
By Pam Shriver, what do you think of the match? And he goes, well, you know, this is a basically rubbish match. Pretty rubbish.
I think it's fair to say, with all due respect to both players, given the best matches tend to involve contrast of styles, Raonic versus Querrey isn't necessarily the neutral's dream ticket, is it?
No. You probably have to really make sure you know, got yourself a good book. just in case.
Yeah, Goran probably had his phone out sort of underneath the underneath the chair. Anyway, I would expect that little dalliance to continue into Miami.
Yes, look, as you've said a number of times, Goran's bursting for an appointment with somebody. He needs something to keep him out of the tour and get his teeth into another Grand Slam champion to be. And actually, Raonic is a great prospect for him in as much as he's reached a Wimbledon final. He's obviously got a huge game. There's stuff to work with. And he's got another bloke who he can just say, just go out and hit the thing.
On that note, women's tennis, David. What impersonations have you got for us in the Osaka Kazakhina front? Apparently, we've all been pronouncing Kazakhina wrong as
have
well.
We?
Yeah.
Oh no! What have we got to call it?
Some Kazatkina or something like that.
Oh,
but
dear.
I can't bring myself to do it quite yet.
No, that's that. Could
and I always and doing. I do think with the Russian and some of the Baltic names, it doesn't quite track the exact pronunciation, the exact emphasis you're supposed to put on the various syllables. It doesn't actually translate into English brilliantly, so that this is all justification for us continuing to say Kazakhina for the duration of this episode.
Yes,
after which we will conduct an inquiry and make sure we get it right.
Okay, yeah, well, those two have put a smile on my face over the last week, and I think just about anybody who loves the sport. both of them in different ways have come along over the last 3 years and at times have just made the heart sing because of the way they come out and play with style and just
very different style as well.
They're swashbuckling players, but as you say, in completely different ways. Both incredibly likable, I think, when you hear from them, when you hear them interviewed, when you speak to them. I've not interviewed Kasatkina before.
Kasatkina.
I have not interviewed her yet before, but I did interview Osaka at the US Open. She's the one who told me a joke in an interview, which I'd never had before. And she showed the sort of personality she had in the presentation when she gave her incredible acceptance speech, her first ever on the Pro Tour, and you could kind of tell, but she just lapped it up. And I think somebody on Twitter said it was just peak awkwardness because the way she sort of addressed the crowd.
Though I know what you mean, but it's not.
It's just her.
She is
lovable. The way she delivers the lines, it's so natural. It's just her, and she doesn't try and just lay it on with a trowel the way so many players are asked to do by media coaches and agents, etc.
She's one of those players like you know, Madison Keys when she first burst on the scene, that 6-3, 6-2 over a Kasatkina in the final yesterday, and other, you know, a whole week of absolutely sensational victories. When she's playing tennis like that and she's winning the matches, you sort of think, well, how is she ever going to lose a tennis match? Like, it seems completely, you know, well, obviously she's just going to win everything from now on. It just looks so not easy for her because she's been on the scene for a couple of years and she has had to work through it. It's not all come really easily, but her tennis is so good and so pure that now she's got it clicked into gear. I know this isn't how it'll be, but it just looks like how can this go wrong?
Yeah, if you line her game up against just about anybody, strictly the shots, what she can do, then she stands alongside anybody. It is Serena Williams-like in terms of its power and precision and the athleticism she has as well. But I was thinking, I mean, bear in mind this is somebody who beat along the way. Maria Sharapova, I know she's injured. She's pulled out of Miami, forearm injury, etc. Beat her straightforwardly. And she thrashed all of these people in straight sets. Agnieszka Radwanska. Who else did she beat along the way? I mean, she
Pliskova.
Beat Pliskova 3-2, I think. You know, these are just thumpings that she's dishing out to really top players, is Naomi Osaka. And she's won that title. And the thing is, people were then asking the sort of question that we always ask, which is, right, now what? How far can this player go? Is this a top five player of the future? Is this a world number one of the future? Is this a Grand Slam champion
of
the future? Yeah, and she thrashed Halep as well. My feeling is, I mean, I don't know Naomi Osaka at all. I've only interviewed her that once. Seen her speak a lot of times, and just even trying to pick up things she says and in social media and the way she says them. My one question mark is, does she really want all that? Is she really that into it in terms of what comes with it, the spotlight, the attention?
But you don't necessarily have to want all that. You just have to be able to cope with all that.
I know, but don't those two things come hand in hand in a way? If you don't want it, can you cope with it? That's
my big question mark. We have had more shy and not necessarily retiring, but we have had more reluctant number ones over the years. Yeah, there are some that adore the spotlight and are extremely comfortable in it, and it certainly presents an obstacle dealing with all of that. Look at Angelique Kerber and how... But that was as much, I think, the pressure of being world number one as the... I think there was a lot going on there with her at number one. It was a combination of the pressure and also the distractions and the difficulty of adjusting to a new lifestyle. I think I get the impression Osaka would be okay with the pressure. The lifestyle aspects,
I just wonder subconsciously
more of an adjustment.
Whether it might take an edge off her desire to be the very best she can be, because it's not really her to have all that around. I'm just not sure.
Andy Murray's not into all that kind of stuff, though.
But he has such an insatiable desire to compete.
You don't think is it that that's missing then?
I just don't know. Just I don't know. I don't know her. I can't tell. I mean, look,
let's get to know her better.
The
David.
Other thing is, well, absolutely. The other thing is, though, Catherine, she is a player who doesn't need to play the sport the way Andy Murray does, who needs to just fight and scrap for stuff. I know he's got a bigger game than some, but she's got the sort of game that can overwhelm. She can win matches easily. So she can win matches within herself. Now, I think in order to absolutely maximise her career, she's going to need to push as well. And then there's that question mark to me. How hard does she want to push? How good does she want to become?
Well, I for one, and I know I'm not alone in this, it's such a Naomi Osaka bandwagon these days, isn't it? Everyone just loves her. But I desperately hope she does want it enough to realise her talent, because, she's just so great. She's so unguarded, and she's just really cool. But she's cool in a completely relatable way. If I was 18, I would desperately want to be like Naomi Osaka, and that's brilliant, isn't it? She's exactly the sort of person that people should want to be like. She's just herself. She's really cool without trying to be. She's a wonderful bundle of sort of awkward self-consciousness and total self-assuredness. She knows she's a bit self-conscious and awkward, but she's also sort of cool with that.
Yeah, she embraces it.
She embraces it, and she knows she's got a talent, but she manages to be completely down to earth and all the rest of it. I just think that people wanting to be like Naomi Osaka, girls or boys, is a great thing. So the more prominence she can rise to, the better.
Do you know, I agree with that, because, yeah, it's very easy to want to put champions and stars in a certain identikit, isn't it, and just have them all come out the mold in the same way and saying the right things, etc. And actually, people looking up to them don't always say the right things, don't always feel that polished and smooth, etc. And yeah, I agree with you. Maybe that's a role model for good. Don't polish off the edges too vociferously. Let her be who she is.
And Doria Kazakina, in a way, I mean, poor thing, she's been overshadowed by Osaka in terms of the result, obviously, and just because Osaka is so captivating personality-wise, but she's pretty cool herself, Kazakina. She's not a cookie-cutter, identikit, just conveyor belt type of person. She's got a bit of edge.
Oh, for sure.
She's got a very interesting, watchable game. Completely different to Osaka.
And a game that for a couple of years has stagnated. Wonderful talent when she first came along. Certainly over the last year or so, there's been this feel that, well, where's the identity? What is she trying to be? How does she win her points? How does she win her matches? A little Dimitrov-like in that way. She can do all this stuff, but to what end? You know, it's reactive. Now it feels like she's got a coach who's really clocked who she is and what she's about and how to use her toolkit. And oh, it's such a joy to watch, because it's all spins and floaty and fancy pictures that she's painting, brush strokes rather than ground strokes.
Speaking of joy to watch, David, you've seen the Miami draw.
I have seen the Miami draw.
It's so interesting, isn't it? It's such an amazing punctuation mark to the debate that was being had this week as a result of some really interesting comments from Simona Halep. Simona Halep rocked up to watch the Williams sisters play one another, a match which was just about to happen when we recorded our podcast last week. She turned up as a fan of the Williams sisters to watch, and of course she ended up being asked about that in Indian Wells, and she said how great they are, paid tribute to them, and she said, look, I'm a de facto number one. Serena Williams is the best player in the world, and she ought to have some sort of protected ranking, not necessarily number one, but there ought to be some sort of provision for maternity leave for players taking time off. And Steve Simon, the CEO of WTA, has said that is something that will be looked into. It can't be implemented straight away. But as a glorious punctuation mark to all of that debate, Naomi Osaka, champion of Indian Wells, has drawn Serena Williams in round one in Miami.
Fantastic.
I mean, you just could not make that up. It's ridiculous.
It's brilliant. When is that match? I want to book off the night. That's going to be fantastic to watch. Just quickly on that, I think it's a shame in a way that sometimes these things have to come up in order for us to address them. But it's good news that Serena Williams' pregnancy and absence and etc. has now shone a light on the fact that needs addressing, and is now being talked about as somebody who needs to be able to come back and have a place in the seedings, you know, rather than just being shunted aside because she's been out of the game being pregnant for a year. The other thing is, I thought that was great to see Simona Halep wanting to go and watch the Williams sisters play each other and just be a fan of the sport and two people who've been so important to the sport. For the reigning world number one to do that, that's great.
Yeah, I very well said, David. I couldn't have said it better myself. Couple of other bits of news from the week in tennis. Now, it was a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it, that we were talking about the ITF proposals for the overhaul of the Davis Cup, backed by Gerard Piquet and his billions. His many, many billions.
Got a few quid.
And we knew at the time that Gerard Piquet and his billions had been in conversation with the ATP, and that those conversations, for reasons unknown, or certainly unconfirmed, had broken down. Well, now what's happening is that the ATP are seemingly hastily trying to cobble together a proposal for the revival of the World Team Cup, which is a tournament that existed into the 90s at the end of the year, essentially.
Well, longer than that, actually.
An ATP rival to the Davis Cup. And we now seem to have a sort of team competition arms race going on between the ATP and the ITF to get their plan in place and to get sufficient backing to get it pushed through, because there seems to be a general acceptance that these two events cannot coexist and both be successful. There's only room for one, at most, with the Laver Cup seemingly going nowhere. So now we have this sort of bizarre standoff. We have a bizarre what's the word
I'm
looking
for? I think arms race was a very good
arms race. Yeah,
way of putting it. But they're both making public statements, aren't they? One has
pretty
rushed
bullish
out
public statements.
The ITF have very quickly rushed out their proposal, and that is going to go to a vote in August. They need 2/3 of the vote. Is it 2/3 or 3/4?
Two thirds of the vote.
They need in order to get their proposals through.
An indication seems to be that might be hard work.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be close.
Certainly desperate lobbying going on behind the scenes, I would imagine.
And then, as you say, whilst in Indian Wells, Russell Fuller, I think it was, who reported, and Chris Clary reported the statement of Chris Kermode saying that, you know, our attention is to go ahead with the World Team Cup, which they'd intimated during the Australian Open, I think, or ahead of the Australian Open, that's what they were going to try to do in association with Tennis Australia and effectively run it in place of those ATP events at the start of the year in Brisbane and Sydney and all those.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Kermode in his statement said that it's something they've been working on for 18 months, which I'm quite sure is the case, but certainly there's an acceleration of the cogs turning. Certainly, they are pretty much acknowledging that they're in a total race against time. Jamie Murray has said that he would rather, you know, various people speaking out have said, Jamie Murray said he would rather do the ATP associated event if they can get their act together. Obviously, we've had Marin Cilic on the podcast talking about his backing for the Davis Cup proposal. It's going to divide players. It's going to divide opinion. It's going to divide, which is the problem. I mean, yeah, this division in tennis. I know it's nothing new. These three different governing bodies all seemingly competing with one another, and who know, I've no doubt, well, I've virtually no doubt that at some point in the future there will be a team competition in tennis, whether it be the ATP one, the Davis Cup, whatever, which will be good and will be a success. But Why can't everyone? Why can't we all just get along? And why is the? I know there's plans to revise the Fed Cup, but the women's aspect of it is just being totally left behind, completely in all of it.
Albeit, David Haggerty did say there is an intention in 2020 to do something very similar.
He did, but given that the ATP, I understand why the ATP have no interest in getting the WTA involved, but they're associated with Tennis Australia in this venture. So why aren't Tennis Australia wanting to also engage the WTA and create the that would be the way to make your proposal the king of the proposals. That could be a USP that no one's going for. Unite men's and women's, Hopman Cup style, but make it, do it properly.
There's two things that come out of it for me. One is that anybody without a vested interest in any of this, who doesn't have a property to try to protect or a venture to try to further, I think pretty much agrees, wouldn't it be just great if they could just get together and combine and come up with a great combination of a team competition that has the feel of a fifth slam, as we've talked about here before, and that just, you know, furthers the interests of tennis as opposed to whichever business venture we happen to be talking about. The second thing is, there is a better precedent for this. If you go back 20 years or slightly less and remember the Grand Slam Cup that was inaugurated by the ITF, a multi-million dollar year-end event which happened after the ATP Finals, and you've effectively got, I think it was any player who'd got to the quarterfinals of a slam got into the Grand Slam Cup, and it was sort of 16 player draw and knockout, etc., etc. That lasted for a few years, and certain players earned an absolute fortune by winning that tournament. And then eventually, thankfully, common sense prevailed. The ATP Finals and the Grand Slam Cup merged, became one event, which is the ATP Finals as we know it today. I hope eventually that might happen with this in some way.
But there are absolutely no indications that there's no indications of Olive Branch of any sort of the opposite, really.
That's because everybody's just establishing their ground at this point and seeing if they can do it individually, I would imagine.
But why is that the ultimate? Is it just money? Why is doing it individually the dream?
Well, they would have, I'm quite sure they've had conversations. They just haven't managed to reach any sort of agreement, and therefore they are shouting the loudest if they possibly can.
Do you think the WTA have been involved in any of the conversations?
No idea. I would probably imagine not. But that's only a guess.
What's going to happen then? What are we going to end up with?
Well, like
in 2019,
I'm an optimist.
What's the calendar going to look like?
I don't know
like
about 2019, but I'm an optimist, and I think and I hope eventually there is some sort of realisation that we just need to get in a room and thrash this out and get one decent team competition. In addition to the Laver Cup, probably, because actually that's only a 3-day event. Is it a problem? Probably not.
Federer's deflecting all the questioning, Marvel. Whenever he's asked about any of it, he just ends up talking about how great the Laver Cup is.
Indeed.
Which is, I mean, of course he was. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? He wasn't going to be drawn on it. But there you go. Bits and bobs of business, David, related, I'm very pleased to say, to gin and tonic.
Awesome. Never a bad thing for us.
We've got the Queen's Club Championships, as it has been briefly known for the past few weeks, has a name.
It does. It is to be the Fevertree Championships hereafter. The reason for that is because Fevertree, which is a premium brand mixer drink company,
it's a life-changing form of tonic water.
Life-changing.
Honestly, I've long thought that I should work on some kind of commission for Fevertree. So this is
really?
this is the brand partnership that I've been waiting for. Yeah, it is. I know everyone thinks, oh, you know, Schweppes have got Schweppes, you know, I'm sorted with my Schweppes tonic water. Trying Fevertree will change your attitude towards a gin and tonic. I promise that. And got all
have I paid you to say that? Why are you saying that? Well, I mean, explain this to me.
You should have seen our WhatsApp trail when David informed me just a couple of days ago that Fevertree were going to be the new title sponsor of Queen's, I was beside myself.
Why?
I got all of my different flavours of Fever Tree out of the cupboard in celebration.
She did.
Including my special edition Christmas one.
Right.
Cinnamon and clementine.
I see.
Yeah.
Excellent. So I think they're the third sponsor over the last 40 years after Stella Artois, who we remember so fondly, Aegon the last 9 years. And yes, now Fever Tree are the title sponsors of the Fever Tree Championships. Hence.
Oh. I can taste gin and tonic in my mouth as we speak.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Couple of other bits, David. Charlie the Ferret has been immortalised in artistic form by my lovely mum. It's a bit indulgent for me to bring that up, but as part of Charlie the Ferret's role as our official tennis podcast mascot for the year, he now has a portrait, which one day I'm sure will hang in a gallery of official tennis podcast mascots somewhere. Yeah?
Yeah.
Something to aim for, isn't it?
Yeah, I have to say, your mum did an excellent job. Fantastic
job. She's very, very talented. Yeah. She's very talented. And I know, David, before we wrap things up for podcast number 397...
Crikey, we have that many conversations.
397. I know you wanted to pay tribute to someone that tennis has lost this week.
Yes, Ken Flack, who was very sadly passed away over the last week. Just a real shock as well. It was a sudden illness that he had, and really so upsetting. He was a multiple Grand Slam doubles winner alongside Robert Sagusa. I remember watching Flack and Sagusa. It just rolls off the tongue for me because that was a partnership that I watched throughout my childhood and teen years, and they were great to watch. And it's just so sad, and our hearts, thoughts go out to his family, Ken Flack.
Indeed. So that is the tennis podcast for this week. We'll be back next week, of course. I will have drunk a lot of Fever Tree in that time. We have been, David, if you've no other business to bring to the table, he's not getting his phone out for pole vault. So we've been the tennis podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. And, of course, with Amanga, who I should reiterate, are still offering a discount for tennis podcast listeners. TPODCAST18 is the code, and that gives you 10% off accommodation and on their two tennis promotions for sort of tennis packages, tennis holiday packages, which you can check out on their website, lamanga.com. So make sure you go there if you want a fancy new forehand. But yeah, we've been the tennis podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with Eurosport, with our three executive producers, Melanie Bowes, tennisballs.com, and Triple S, and with the immortalised Charlie the Ferret.
Tired of ads interfering with your favourite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.